Siren Radio.
Hello? Siren 107.3.
Excellent. I don't know. Why do you think Lloyd Gait resigned? It's a tough call, really, in so many ways. Good morning, Yaz. How are you?
Good morning, Alex. How are you doing?
Excellent. Delighted to see you here. And you're ahead, of course, of our American correspondent, of course, Kathy Manso, who, standard American style, a little bit late. Never mind. It's okay. We just have to cope with that. And we will, because clearly we thank Susie Sparkles for a fabulous early morning breakfast show. A couple of weeks' time from now, should be actually expanding to 9 o'clock, and Midweek Drive Morning Edition will go 9 o'clock through 11 o'clock. It's all very changing and wonderful stuff, etc. But Robin Pierce, do you know why Lord Gait might possibly have resigned? I mean, any thoughts on that? Or is it just a case of, well, I mean, you know, I mean, he's got such a fabulous ethical background to work with. I mean, any thoughts at all in Wales?
I think maybe he just wasn't up to the challenge. I thought maybe he saw himself as the Titanic and Boris Johnson as an iceberg.
That's a definite thought. Definite thought. By the way, happy World Clean Air Day. Why are we talking about World Clean Air Day? Because it is World Clean Air Day, and we've got lots of features which will focus on that. Certainly the joy of breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, and yeah, clear those lungs, get the thing sorted, ensure that you actually welcome in the joys of inspiration, expiration, exhalation, all manner of marvellous things as well, including Professor Frank Kelly and Sean Ng, to celebrate World Clean Air, coming up after Jean-Paul Young. Everywhere I look around, love is in the air, every sight and every sound. And I don't know if I'm being fooled, don't know if I'm being wise, but it's something that I must believe in, and it's there when I look in your eyes. Love is in the air, in the whisper of the tree. Love is in the air, in the thunder. We'll be right back. Well, happy World Clean Air Day. What, you didn't realise it was Clean Air Day? Well, it is. But the question is, how clean is our air? 97% of homes exceed WHO limits for at least one of the three key pollutants, while 70% exceed limits for all three. Now, to talk us through the importance of clean air, we're delighted to welcome Professor the School of Public Health at Imperial College London, and indeed part of the Scientific Advisory Board, who's been working on clean air over the years. That's wonderful. Frank Kelly, how are you, Frank?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. And you're obviously in an office there. You're indoors. I'm in an office as well. We're indoors. How clean is our air? That's the big question, of course, that maybe we don't realise that we're taking in materials that can really impact us adversely.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sitting here at White City and I can see, you know, lots of traffic moving past the building. And traditionally, that is the big source of outdoor pollution. And everybody knows about that. And that's why we're, you know, we're going to eventually ban fossil fuels. But we also have problems with indoor pollution. And we spend most of our time indoors, you know, up to 80% for a lot of us, either in homes or in offices or in schools. And so increasingly, we have evidence to say that there are lots of pollutants inside, which are probably not good for our health. So that's what, you know, it's really important to emphasize this as part of Clean Air Day tomorrow.
And this is obviously part and parcel of Clean Air Day 2022, which brings us neatly around to Dyson, what Dyson have actually been getting involved with as far as that's been concerned. We're delighted to speak to design engineer from Dyson, Sean Ng. Sean, welcome to the programme. Frank's shared with us there some of the challenges with respect to not just external air quality, but also internal air quality. What is the kind of research that Dyson are kind of applying to address this issue?
So we've done years of research into this, and we've actually, recent research has found that the air quality in the home can be up to 3.5 times worse than outdoor pollution. And this is because, you know, homes are increasingly well sealed. So you bring in a lot of these dust on your clothes, on your shoes, and it gets tracked into your homes. And then you've got pollen and all the particulates and gases that are coming in from the outside and getting stuck in your homes. And so indoor, a lot of people don't realize that indoor air pollution is actually worse than outdoor air pollution.
I mean, that's something which certainly came across in terms of COVID, Frank, in which we were all encouraged to actually open our windows to actually allow air to circulate and so on and so forth. And now it would seem the pandemic is actually passed. And if we're not worried about monkeypox, then clearly we've got other issues that are working through this. Is it a case of we do need to ensure that our windows are and our homes are well ventilated?
Yes, I mean, increasingly modern houses are very airtight, and we do need fresh air on a regular basis to dilute down the pollutants which we're generating indoors as well. So if you just think about when you cook, you know, either by gas or electric, you're producing a lot of particles and gases like NO2, nitrogen dioxide. Now, that's simply the same as burning fuel in your vehicle. So but because we can't see this and we can't usually smell it, then we don't think about it. We don't open the windows or we don't turn on our, you know, the ventilation system on our cookers. If we light fires in our homes as well, we're producing a lot of pollution. And, you know, increasingly with the energy crisis looming, you know, it's a big worry that people will have to resort to burning solid fuel again. And this will really be a backward step for us.
Lung disease, strokes, heart disease, and dementia, almost the four horsemen of the health apocalypse coming across there. And they're all impacted, according to the World Health Organization, by the quality of our air. I mean, Sean, do you think that actually we're going to get better than this? I mean, there are lots of us who kind of might have thought that once we actually stopped burning fossil fuels, once we started getting into Clean Air Acts, etc., this would have been a problem of maybe the mid-20th century at best.
Well, I think, yeah, with the, I guess it's really important that we need more awareness into air quality, both indoors and outdoors. And I think, like, there has been an increasing awareness of that indoor air quality. But, with modernization, you know, you've got so many different products going to your homes, you know, people are starting to renovate their homes more. So even like with cleaning products and using all kinds of cosmetics and perfumes. So all of that actually has things like volatile organic compounds, which may have like impacts on people's well-being. So we have to also be mindful of those possible sources of pollution.
Now, ahead of the 16th of June and Clean Air Day, of course, the James Dyson Foundation, the Dyson Environmental Care Engineers, are all apparently down tools and headed off to their hometowns to deliver air quality education to students at their old schools. Do you think the message is getting across? Were the students panicked? Did they go away even more stressed? What was the sort of general impact of that?
Yeah, I think that those activities were really well received by the students, and actually a lot of our engineers have had positive feedback from the students, and the students were actually got the opportunity to prototype and come up with different solutions and ideas to help air pollution. And actually, they actually came up with really good ideas like purifying lampposts and drones that monitor and clean up the air. And so I think it's good to have that awareness like brought into our schools from young, so that these kids grow up to have like really good like ideas of air pollution.
Frank, is it all about education? I mean, you've just been working on a project that combines 20,000 measurements using computer modelling to produce pollution estimates every 20 metres across the UK. I must admit, I was quite surprised to see that the towns and cities with the highest proportion of homes in the top 10% were Slough in Berkshire, London, Portsmouth, Leeds, Manchester, Reading and Southampton. Lincoln obviously didn't quite make that table from that point of view, but is it something which education can help with, or is it a case of, well, we need to, in the immortal words of our current leaders, deal with it and live with it?
Now, education is fundamental at this point in time. I mean, we have lots of information, as we've been talking about that links poor air quality with poor health. We understand the sources of those air pollution, pollutants that we worry about indoors and outdoors. So really what we need to do now is to get everybody on board with that information for two reasons. One, we're all guilty. We all contribute to the air pollution problem. Some of us more than others, but you know, we need everybody to understand their own contribution. And then secondly, they need to, with that understanding, they need to put some pressure on our government and our masters to be able to say, we want better air quality. Simple as that. Because if we don't have that, then, you know, we're just going to be continually increasing the health costs that are associated with breathing poor air. All the diseases you just mentioned, I mean, the poor air quality contributes to all of those. So we need to decrease our health budget, and we need to improve people's lives.
And Sean, as a design engineer from Dyson, is it a case of it's getting better, or is it a case of, well, you know, the poorer the air quality, the more Dyson products we can sell?
Well, I think it's not about just selling purifiers. I think it's really important that people have an awareness of how they could actually improve the air quality in their homes, because there are a lot of ways that simple ways and people could do, for example, cleaning regularly, turning on the extraction system in your kitchen when they're cooking, because you've got all these gases coming out. So it's not just about selling, but I think it's important that we have that awareness of air quality.
And finally, where can people go to find out further details about the survey and the data and contemplate it at their leisure?
So that will be published on our newsroom at dyson.co.uk/newsroom.
Sean Ng, design engineer from Dyson, and Professor Frank Kelly from Imperial College London. Keep on breathing, gentlemen.
Yeah, I thought it was important to actually get that point across. Thank you. No, thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's not mess around in any way, shape or form. Let's actually dig into the archives and listen to an early incarnation of promoting the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
This is the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren 107.3 FM.
That's pure enunciation. That's quality, that. Yeah, I mean, it's so wonderful that I feel we should actually just play it one more time just to actually hear the way the vowels, the consonants are all effectively rounded off.
This is the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren 107.3 FM.
It's like she's announcing at Royal Ascot, isn't it? But she's not Royal Ascot. She's in Wimbledon. Sarah Huntley, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Marvellous. Well. Are you enjoying good air quality on World Air Day? No, World Clean Air Day. I can't stop smiling because
you think though, you, I mean, I don't know how it is in the studio there. I did put my diffuser on. I just wondered whether I'd acted a very naughty act or something, but it's filling the air with rose at the moment.
That's
I'm probably
nice.
Legally burning electricity, but I just like a nice smell around.
Don't we all?
I don't know what that does.
No, we don't. I mean, let's face it, you know, the whole notion of having a nice smell around. Interesting enough, we continue with the product manager at Audi, of course, who'll be discussing clean air. His name, Johnny Byrne. It's just perfect, isn't it? It's absolutely perfect. You know, if you're a product manager at Audi, and of course, Audi do make e-cars, which is what we'll be talking about, e-vehicles. But that's to come, because now it's time, Sarah Huntley, for... Not time to breathe. It's always time to breathe. But time for Robin Pearce to actually step up to the plate. And as Richard Fitzwilliams enjoys another day at Royal Ascot, honestly, I mean, it's just
so we've got Robin
swanning around there. You know, we figured let's go to Robin Pearce, who is clearly going to be on the case when it comes to Jurassic World Dominion. Robin,
good morning.
Welcome to the programme.
Yes, I've seen Dominion. It's one of the films that I was looking forward to most this year, being the sci-fi nut that I am. And I'd actually kept away from all reviews before going in because I didn't want the experience tainted either way, because cynicism seems to be the new cool and I don't understand it. I like to go into a film purely for entertainment purposes, unabashedly enthusiastic. If that's childlike, then I'll be a child. I wanted to wait a few days for the film to percolate because I think this had a lot at stake. As it turned out, most critics didn't care for it that much, but I did, because I actually saw everything I expected to see, and I expected quite a good return, because there have been questions brewing in my mind since before your studio cast of Yaz and Kathy were ever born. What am I talking about? Well, I am actually going somewhere with this. The content of the film is all in the title. It's not Jurassic Park. We don't have our cast members running around a forest on an island with dinosaurs. We did that for 4.5 films. This is Jurassic World. The dinosaurs have, of course, inevitably made their way out into the larger world. And the ecological imbalance is in full play. The subtitle is Dominion. Who has Dominion? Do we have Dominion? I don't think so. Professor Ian Malcolm certainly doesn't think so. As he says, we're racing towards the extinction of our species. We not only lack dominion over nature, we're subordinate to it. Right. Though all the animals are now free, we have pterodons building nests in skyscrapers. You know, cities are brought to a standstill as dinosaurs just walk through at will. We do have a lovely Valley of Guanji moment when we see some dinosaurs being corralled and lassoed. But what would we humans actually do in this circumstance? Being what we are, we would factory farm them. We would exploit them. We would poach them. And worst of all, we would weaponize them. And this is what the film examines. How do we weaponize a dinosaur? Well, imagine having programmed a raptor so that if it sees a little laser pointer dot at somebody, that's all it'll ever go for. until it has actually slaughtered its target. So, ethics are at the forefront of this. Can we? Should we? Well, of course we shouldn't. And it's a film that brings the two casts of all six films together. We have the reuniting of the cast from the original Jurassic Park films, and we have the cast of the Jurassic World films. There's a new organization. It's not InGen anymore. This answers a huge question, that these are the two questions I've had burning. There's an interesting scene in Jurassic Park featuring a character called Dodgson, who employs Nedry to steal the embryos from Jurassic Park. Nedry fails. He loses not only his life, but the embryos in a mudslide, in a fake can of shaving foam. Whatever happened to those? I've wanted to know this since 1993. Question is answered. Who was Dodgson anyway? Was he a middleman? Was he working for somebody? Was he the master manipulator? Did he want these embryos for himself? If so, what for? Was he going to make a dinosaur omelette? What's going on? Again, these questions are fully answered. And if this film is the last in the entire six-film run, then I'm leaving it quite happy. If I was to mark this, it would be getting a 9 out of 10. Now, to put this in context, in this particular trilogy, I would give Jurassic World 10, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, the second in the trilogy, an 8, because I felt that slipped. But this brings it round, and for me, it was a very satisfactory ending, and it was great seeing the whole cast together with some amazing action sequences and some truly jaw-dropping special effects.
And I think it's fair to say Richard Fitzwilliams won't like it. But never mind. Let's move on. Sarah Huntley, will you, on the basis of Robin's sterling recommendation there, the fact that it answers questions that have been bugging him for over 3 decades, will you go and be checking out Jurassic World Dominion?
Well, I think I will, because Robin's done such a good job at explaining it, if you're somebody that hasn't really seen any of it, that I feel you filled me in very nicely. Yes, I have to say it's not really my genre, but it has whetted my appetite, so yes, I will be going to see it.
Oh. Yes, DeGraff.
Yeah, I agree with Sarah. Robin did amazing. Especially with the music going on, I feel like I'm still like into it right now.
It was a specific request from John Williams to effectively say, can I please provide a backing trailer for Robin Pierce's movie review? He never asks for that with Richard Fitzwilliams. He's never, ever done that. But, you know, for Robin, he said, I'd like to do it. So thank you.
It went very nice.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's definitely something that I'll definitely watch.
Brings it to an end. Kathy Manso.
Oh, Robin, you do this every time when you have a passion and explaining something. I'm eager just to follow you on this journey. And you've convinced me once again to go see a movie of your liking. But to be fair, I'm a little bit biased because I love Jurassic Park and I love Jurassic World already. So nothing was going to hold me back from seeing it. But I'm glad I'm going to get those questions answered. I thought the can was meant to be given to the CIA from the first film, or CIA-like agents' abilities, but now I have more questions that I didn't realize that I had. So thank you.
Always more questions than answers. The film received generally negative reviews from critics who criticized its screenplay and runtime, with many claiming that the franchise had run its course.
How dare they?
That's the thought.
Absolutely, how dare they?
Anyway, doing our public service aspects of broadcasting here at Siren Radio, Kathy, I'm going to turn to your good self now to actually make a decision, possibly advised by maybe Yaz, maybe Sarah. Robin is out of this for reasons which will become quite clear. We can offer you, musically speaking, a choice of two. We can go down the line of Bruce and Bongo with Guile. Okay, that's Bruce and Bongo, Guile. Very popular, kind of like sick in German, but you know, it's kind of vernacular. So Bruce and Bongo and Guile, bet I might. Thinking about Audi, obviously looking ahead to Audi, Guile, etc. Vorsprung durch Technik. It's all the sort of things from that. Or Lieutenant, not Lieutenant, Lieutenant Pigeon. Lieutenant Pigeon with Moldy Old Dough. Okay, so Lieutenant Pigeon, Sarah might recall the joys of Lieutenant Pigeon and Moldy Old Dough. She's all good.
She does not recall. I would like everyone to know that she does not recall.
Oh, I'm surprised, because we, you know, it was.
He
it was,
knows what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing.
Robin, I said you have to step aside really from this. I don't want to meet you, Robin. I don't want you to do a Richard now. You know, I mean, it's only Richard Fitzwilliams has actually had the record of being muted twice on one of these shows. Just don't go back on that. So, Sarah, what would you advise? Would you go Moldy Old Doe, Lieutenant Pigeon, or Bruce and Bongo Guile?
Well, they all sound interesting. Mm-hmm. I suppose, really, we have to go for Moldy Old Doe.
What are your thoughts,
Is it
Kathy?
Some folk music or something?
It's actually a song which got to number one in the 1970s, Sarah. So it actually did make number one in the old sort of chart days where charts meant something as opposed to downloads, etc. It shot up through the system and really was a tribute in so many ways to the three-day week, to Ted Heath's government, to the joys of times past, really. And of course, let's say Lieutenant Pigeon, not Lieutenant Pigeon, which presumably was the reason it never quite took off in America.
Are all these quotes from the same song?
Are they what, from the same song, Sarah?
Are all the quotes from the same song?
Well, the quotes, when you say quotes, actually the only lyric in Moldy Old Doe is indeed that. Moldy Old Doe, okay?
It does ring a bell somewhere, but I can't think what bell it's ringing.
Kathy?
I really thought she was going to go with Guile, but, you know, she surprised me with the moldy old choice. So, Alex, how would you describe Guile in, like, three words?
In three words, irritating, German, and wacky.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just saying that. I mean,
do we want to give that to the listeners?
It's not a Ying Tang song, you know, which caused huge problems last night. I don't know why. It's just anyway. Yaz, any thoughts from yourself?
You know, I think I'm just going to go with what Sarah has picked. Yeah. I think I thought she wasn't going to go for it.
Right.
But she did. And so since that, you're surprised. The listeners should be
so
surprised.
So are we ready then for Moldy Old Doe? This will please Robin no end.
Moldy
actually.
Old Doe. Let's do
Moldy
it.
Old Doe. 2 minutes, 39 seconds. Ready? Breathe in. Ready for this morning exercises? Let's go. the second biggest selling single of 1973 there, Sarah. You may remember Lieutenant Pigeon, obviously an anagram of genuine potential, the number one hit, which of course featured Hilda on the piano. Sarah, you must surely remember Moldy Old
Dough. I do. And actually, I do remember it because that faint tune that was going on in my head when I said, let's have Moldy Old Dough, was what I was thinking of. So tell me the relevance with Robin.
Well, I mean, Robin is going to hopefully be humming Lieutenant Pigeon for the majority of the day. Will that not be the case, Robin?
Yes, thank you for that earworm. I mean, I turn up on time, I turn up prepared, I do my best, and this is what you do to me.
Yeah, but you like it, really. That's the important thing. Of course, the adaptation, of course, the 1920s jazz phrase, vaudevio, is a kind of a version of Moldy Old Dough, apparently. And indeed, the band of the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, a bagpipe version of Amazing Grace, produced, of course, by our very own Peter Kerr, from, of course, the New York Book Festival. That was the one song that actually beat 1973's Moldy Old Dough. Great times, Robin, eh?
73 was not a good year, was it?
That's Slade and Merry Christmas, everybody. Yeah, yes. Do you think the right decision was made?
I think it was quite interesting. I kind of liked it.
I mean, I was kind of hoping
at least
for
Kathy
Robin.
Manso stayed in the studio this time.
Whoa, shots fired. You know what? I'm going to fire right on back, Robin. I was hoping you were going to sing the lyrics to Moldy Old. Yeah, there we go.
Moldy Old Dough.
Yes.
You people are just making me suffer.
Well, never mind, because coming up, we'll be speaking to Johnny Byrne, product manager at Audi. Then, of course, Jörg Henschel, who'll be talking about the reopening of the world's largest beer garden in Nuremberg. Who would have thought Nuremberg, famous for so many rallies over the years, has suddenly actually gone into the world's
beer garden?
A beer garden, exactly. They use the castle and they actually fill the moat with beer.
Oh, what a dream.
These Germans, outrageous. Kathy, would you like to put those last two questions to Sarah and to Robin in whichever order you wish?
All right, yes. My first question to the beautiful team on the screen. Hello. Have you had an interestingly good Zoomer with us today?
Ladies first.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. And absolutely. We love to hear it. Okay, my next question and final question is, will you be returning with us another time, maybe in the very near future?
I would love to, and it's so lovely seeing Kathy and Yaz in the studio with, well, I can't quite see Alex. I can see
Alex's
hand.
There we are. It's just a hand. It's like a thing from the Addams Family. You know, it's kind of saying all sorts of things there. Yeah, you know, puppet tunes and so on.
Ignore the man behind the curtain.
It's great to see you guys. You look very... I don't know, it just makes it more of a show. It's lovely having you guys.
Yeah, believe me, Sarah, as you know, over the last 3 decades, we've been trying to make it more of a show since we started, but there we are. Life continues. So next question then. Will they return? You've asked them.
Yeah, I've asked,
of course,
didn't I?
Yeah,
I thought.
Short-term
oh my
memory.
Did I have a stroke? Oh, my gosh.
I will be back if I can see the playlist first.
Oh, Robin, you know, where's your adventure when it comes to it? We might hold back Guile. Or then again, I might bring in Guile after Jörg Henschel. Who knows? It's a thought.
So, I appreciate it.
As I said, you know, we've got a whole new line of things. The most popular word, apparently, Guile in German. It means a number of key things, basically. Okay, then, Sarah Huntley, have a great day. Take care. Robin Huntley, enjoy your Thursday. And we'll see you, doubtless, on Resonance Rewind or more exciting programmes as we proceed. In fact, Robin, I believe...
Robin Huntley will return.
Yeah, now, that's an amalgamation, which is quite shocking, really. It's almost as though he's been genetically engineered from Jurassic Park, really. It's strange. It's still
spoilers.
Yeah. Jurassic Park 7.
We can hope.
Say farewell, Sarah.
Farewell, and keep breathing, everybody,
today. Very true. And keep on clapping as well. Here are the Bell Stars on Siren Radio, 107.3 FM, and time coming round to 23 and a half minutes to 9 o'clock.
and they all went to heaven in a little rowboat.
It is Clean Air Day, as we've said several times on the programme already, and fuel prices are clearly continuing to increase, with the average cost to fill a family car now exceeding £100. That, of course, Cathy, would translate as $200.
Would it?
Yeah.
£100 to $200?
Is it?
I thought it'd be like $137.
Really? Is it as low as that?
Hey, I don't think the pound is as strong as it used to be in this economy.
You'll always dig the Okay, fair enough. Still excessive from that point of view. Pollution, of course, air pollution causing up to 36,000 deaths in the UK every year. And this is one of the reasons why we're thinking about obviously having to be nudged towards electric cars. Do you drive, Yaz?
In Bermuda, yes.
Do you drive an electric car in Bermuda?
No, I do not.
Would you consider driving an electric car in Bermuda?
Yes.
Cathy, what about yourself? I mean, you don't drive in Britain. You do drive in the US. You've driven extensively in the US. So, I mean, an electric car going across the United States probably doesn't bear thinking about it, doesn't it? It's not going to last, is it? Or is it?
It depends on the charging stations, I guess. My idea for a road trip, because I used to have to drive from Miami to Tallahassee pretty often, and that's a 7-hour drive. And when you do that, I'm a morning driver, so I'd rather get up at like 5 in the morning to be on the road by 5:30 to beat the Miami traffic, which, believe me, is worth it to do it that early.
See, I'm the same on Mondays. You know, I leave Teesside at usually about 4:30 a.m. to get here by 7 a.m., 126 miles.
It's preferred. I mean, I'd rather just, you know, I don't want to be, I'd rather actually drive than just be sitting in the car. But there's only one time that I fill up the tank when I have to do a long journey like that, and that's in Orlando. And then I can continue going on the whole way. One time I even drove on one complete tank of gas, which was quite an accomplishment from Miami to Tallahassee. But I am someone who does very few stops. I want to get there as quickly as possible and as pleasantly. And when you have an electric car to consider, you're probably going to have to stop once or twice.
These are questions we will put to Johnny Byrne, product manager at Audi, in a few moments, because they're all viable ones. And although clearly the move is to go electric, get that sort of through, in terms of cost, actually, you could save up to £1,800 literally by making a switch to electric vehicles. But
I have a question though. Isn't the big news that by the goal is to have no petrol cars by 2030?
That is the official target.
Do you think it's going to be possible?
That is the law.
It's the law.
That's what we have been told. That's what our leaders have said.
Masters.
the time has arrived when we can actually welcome back to the Midweek Drive the awesomely wonderful soul product manager at Audi. Of course, that's Johnny Byrne. How are you, Johnny?
Sorry,
Neil,
back-to-back.
No, it's, they're still actually not ready for us. They're still waiting for that whole process. Johnny Byrne, welcome to the Midweek Drive live. No, he's still chatting. They haven't obviously opened up his microphone. We can actually listen in and randomly sort of select this whole process that's coming through. Maybe not. Yeah, it will be exciting, but maybe not. As we said, pain at the pumps, fueling EV demand. The cost is rising. And if you switch to electric, you can make some significant savings. Now, will Johnny Byrne be actually there and able to talk to us about this? Johnny Byrne, can you hear us and are you connected?
Dramatic pause.
There is a dramatic pause, though. Yeah, very strange. Maybe we need to actually... I'll press a little button here and hope for the best whilst we actually take another little mini excerpt from Prefab
Alex,
Spread.
Can you hear
us? Yes, we can hear. Can't actually hear it. Wait a second whilst I sort this little magic thing out. Press that there. And I think they should be able to hear us now. Sorry about that, Shippy, our engineer extraordinaire. We just realised we'd actually muted ourselves in all sorts of ways. So we gave a big build-up to Johnny Byrne, and he couldn't hear a word. Not to worry. Johnny, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
We're splendid. Now, in the studio, we've got an American. We've got a Jamaican. Bermudan. I keep getting
confused.
Yeah, it's not the same at all. Both of whom, both Kathy and Yaz, drive vehicles. They don't drive electric vehicles. Kathy, you had a quick question about electric vehicles, which concerned you if you were using them in the States.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of American drivers, they tend to drive for many hours at a time, not just to work, but road trips. When I was living in Florida, I was doing a lot of road trips from Miami to Tallahassee, and that's a 7-hour drive if you're doing some good timing. How often would you have to stop in order to charge your car if it's electric?
Yeah, no, it's a valid point. I think that's one of the concerns, and part of the research we've done, one of the main concerns was the charging infrastructure. I don't have figures for America, but in the UK, there are just in excess of 30,000 charging units. And the government has promised over £1 billion worth of investment to increase that figure to between 250,000 and 400,000 units by 2030. So there is a massive, massive expansion ongoing. But what we're doing at Audi is investing in that, along with other OEMs, is a high-speed recharging infrastructure called Ionity, which will charge your electric car up to 80% in 20 minutes. So that's a perfect amount of time for a quick coffee and a comfort break. And this network will go across the UK and Europe. So it's a concern that people have had, but it's something that's being addressed by government and companies such as Audi at the same time.
So in terms of the difference between electric cars, which, as Yaz rightly said, will be illegal, manufacture of electric cars will be illegal against the law from 2030 onwards, what are the kind of key differences, Johnny? I mean, there's still a lot of concerns, a lot of myths that are coming across here, and I think a lot of people were, no pun intended, burned badly over the diesel scenario. We were promised at the start of the century, you want to be clean, you want to be good for the environment, get yourself a diesel car. That didn't turn out so well. What's the guarantee that electric isn't going the same way?
Yeah, I think one of the concerns when this technology was first launched with electric vehicles was the cost of them. I think when any new technology comes along, whether that's smartphones or particularly flat screen televisions, they were very, very expensive, and that was to a point the case with electric cars. But when technology is developed over time and the entry point of that comes down, it's a lot more accessible. So today in our range, our latest fully electric car, the Q4 e-tron, it's comparable with the petrol vehicle we also have, if not cheaper, depending on the specific model. And that's just on list price. Once you factor in the potential cost savings of running these vehicles, you can save anywhere between £1,500 to £1,800 per year on fuel if you were to do about 12,000 miles per year, which I do. So there are huge benefits to these cars, especially and from an environmental point of view as well.
Yeah, you could actually save enough to maybe pay your home electricity bill. Maybe, I don't know. Yes, any questions?
I think I am good on questions. I'm still very interested. I was thinking about getting a car in the UK, getting a little driver's license, and I was looking at electric cars. So
So here we are, Johnny, somebody who could well be in the market for an Audi electric car. What words would you say to persuade Yaz to say, yeah, go electric, Yaz, don't go petrol?
Yeah, it's a completely valid point, because the research we did also showed that a lot of the younger generation are greatly considering electric vehicles more than the older generation. And that's a shift we really are beginning to see. And I would definitely urge you to go and take a test drive of one of our vehicles, because one of the regrets people have about these cars is they wish they'd done it sooner. Once you factor in the cost saving, the environmental benefits, and also the experience of driving these cars, they are a lot more relaxing. They're a lot more refined to drive. There is no engine. It's completely silent and smooth. People regret not making the switch earlier, so I can't recommend it highly enough.
What convinced you, Johnny, to actually switch to electric? I mean, apart from saying, well, I work for Audi, obviously I've got to switch to electric.
Yeah, well, I'm in a very fortunate position to get to drive all sorts of Audi vehicles. The first electric vehicle we launched in 2018 was the e-tron. So it was the first of its kind in that area of the market. And since then we've launched the e-tron GT, which is a very elegant four-door coupe. And then following that was a smaller, more compact Q4 e-tron. They are, as I've mentioned, greatly advantageous when it comes to cost, especially today when the cost of fuel is increasing what it seems to be every day. So the savings are just getting larger and larger the more you use this car. But also the driving experience. My commute is about 100 miles. It's not short. So when I do have to do it in a completely silent and relaxing electric car, it makes that journey a lot more enjoyable.
Kathy, an enjoyable journey. Are you being persuaded?
I mean, I am. Don't get me wrong. If I can use less petrol, I would definitely jump on the opportunity. I guess my concerns come down to I want to inquire about getting the materials to essentially build these kind of cars. Is it as sustainable? Because you know the problems that there are just with like making an iPhone, even though I have an iPhone.
It may well be beyond Johnny's brief, but yeah, in terms of that sustainability, is that something else Audi is looking to address?
Yeah, it's a completely valid point. It's something we really are addressing. The obvious CO2 saving with an electric vehicle is from the tailpipe. So if you were to drive 12,000 miles per year, which I do, that's potentially 3,000 kilograms, 3 tons of CO2 from entering the atmosphere. But within where we build these cars and our factories around the world and mainly in Europe, we're taking a complete root and branch approach to reducing CO2. So the factories these cars are built in, these fully electric Audis, they will all be net carbon neutral by 2025. The first site in Brussels in Belgium was the first in the world to be net carbon neutral, and that is an approach, a commitment we've made by 2025 that every facility around the world where we build these cars will be net carbon neutral. And that goes for our suppliers at the same time. We're encouraging them to use green energy to produce the parts that we use and the logistics to get these cars around to customers at the same time. So it's a complete overhaul of the whole infrastructure.
75% increase in the number of Audi electric vehicle sales in the last 12 months, which is good. Still only 10% of Audi UK sales that are electric from that perspective. I mean, inevitably, if you want to have your own vehicle, you're going to have to switch to an electric car in some way, shape or form. Do you think affordability is also something which is changing, Johnny? Do you think that actually, you know, these will become within the range of most people as opposed to, I can't afford that electric car and pay an electric bill?
Yeah, precisely. As I think I mentioned earlier, the cost of entry into these vehicles is now comparable, if not cheaper, at Audi models. So while the take up is relatively low, 1 in 10 of our vehicles is electric, but that is increasing. And by 2026, every new Audi we launch will be electric. So we are fully committed to this technology. And we've seen the switch already with some of our vehicles. Our fully electric vehicles, the Q4 that I talked about, is on track to be one of our best sellers this year. The e-tron, which we launched in 2018, already outsells the petrol diesel equivalent, which is the Q7. So our customers are asking for this technology. They want this technology. And the the sales are gradually increasing. We're in a transition period. So it's exactly what we expected to see. These changes don't happen overnight. They take a time and a lot of investment, billions of investment. But it's a switch we're seeing and we are fully committed to.
And do you have a particular personal favourite within the Audi range, Johnny, or is that a bit like asking an author to select their favourite novel?
It's a valid point, but yeah, personally, while they are all fabulous electric vehicles, the e-tron GT is a very, very special car. Very elegant four-door coupe. One of the best-looking Audis we've made and an incredible drive.
There you go. Kathy, last two questions for Johnny Byrne, please.
Of course. So my first question for you is, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Yes, it's been great.
This is good. You know, he's sorted out. We thought it'd be okay, but, you know, a slight sort of hiccup at the start there, but then we obviously need to unmute ourselves. It's part of the course.
We always recover.
And will you be kind enough to return, Johnny, in the not-too-distant future to keep us more informed about how the electric vehicle is beginning to become ubiquitous?
Absolutely. Happy to come back anytime.
More than cars and girls. Look at us now. Start counting. While that's up the way. things hurt more, much more than cars and girls.
Well, they said it couldn't be banned forever, and they were quite right. Despite COVID, the world's largest beer garden is back in action this year. Hurrah, hurrah, all the way around the world. We can hear this resonating. And we're delighted to welcome the travel expert from Franconia Tourism to talk about this Nuremberg beer garden. That's the fabulous Jörg Henschel. How are you, Jörg?
Hello, Alex. I'm fine, thanks.
Excellent. Well, I mean, this is great news, obviously, for people who like that particular beer. Over 300 German breweries will be serving thousands upon thousands of litres of beer to tourists in this beer festival. Share with us, in terms of this Franconian beer festival in Nuremberg, why basically it's established this tremendous routine and why, thankfully, it's now back with us.
Well, after a two-year break due to the coronavirus, the Franconian Beer Festival is finally taking place again in the beautiful ambience of the castle mode in Nuremberg. Nuremberg is our biggest city in Franconia with 500,000 inhabitants, and Franconia is the region between Frankfurt and Munich. So the beer festival starts tomorrow, and we are looking for over 5 days of festivities with a wide-ranging program. You can enjoy the live music, many culinary delights, and surprise, there will be also a show brewery where you can experience firsthand how brew specialities are made with craftsmanship from four ingredients. It's water, malt, hops, and yeast in hand-forged copper kettles. So, yeah, big days are coming in Nuremberg.
Well, it certainly looks as though it's going to be an outstanding experience, and presumably mixing the best of traditional German brewing and beer with respect to modern things, etc. Share with us, though, Jörg, what are the types of beers that people can expect there? Is it literally every beer known to humanity?
Well, you will find many different types of beer. A lot of privately owned breweries present over 100 different craft beers in the Franconian Beer Festival. And every brew tastes a little different. Every variety has its own flavor. And it all depends on what kind of hops was used and which spring the water came from. So our guests can look forward to many different types. For example, smoked beer that tastes like smoked ham, the red beer, light and mild beers, or white beer. So, and there are also non-alcoholic beers as well.
There is, I suppose, a kind of fairy tale element as well to the Nuremberg Castle, and the fact that it's the moat that's transformed into the largest beer garden. Was that something that was always the intention, to become the world's largest beer garden? I mean, normally we kind of hear things like the world's largest in Texas, for instance, not Nuremberg.
Well, it's only during the beer festival for 5 days, and it's the largest beer garden because we have so many breweries at one time at the same place. So I think that's the unique experience. However, we don't only have the beer festival in Nuremberg. There are, during summertime, a lot of beer festivals all over in Franconia. For example, the Annafest in Forchheim, the Beer Week in Kulmbach, or the Michaeliskirchweih in Fürth. So if you can't come within the next days to Franconia, you can look forward to many different other opportunities.
You mentioned, obviously, the pandemic, the coronavirus, the issue related to that. We've clearly got a cost of living crisis that's impacting now. For folk who are kind of umming and ahhing about this, and as you said, perhaps this might just be a little bit too late for people to say, right, I'm going to get on my own private jet and fly over tomorrow straight away. Would you say, I mean, this is something which obviously is growing. And do you feel as though the festival is, you know, taking some tentative steps back into the public light after, obviously, a two-year hiatus?
Well, the prices raised up during the past weeks, yes. However, it's still much cheaper than the October Festival in Munich, for example. You can experience a lot and get good food, good beers, for, yeah, and a very good quality.
I was going to mention the Oktoberfest, of course. Is there any sense of competition with the Oktoberfest, or is it a case of no? At the end of the day, Nuremberg obviously has the Oktoberfest beaten hands down.
As it's during different several months, so there's no great competition. I think both festivals have their strengths. Instead of the October festival, you don't sit inside a tent, but under the open sky and enjoy the great weather that's during the summer month.
Now, I've been looking at frankentourismus.com, of course, and some of the jewels that you actually got there, of course, the cities of Ansbach, Aschaffenburg, Bamberg, Bayreuth, of course, known for its opera, Dinkelsbühl, Eichstätt, Erlangen, Fürth, Kulm. I mean, it does seem as though you're overflowing with riches and so on. And it's fair to say that even if you're not a beer drinker, there's probably something to attract you in terms of the Franconia region.
Exactly. We have in Franconia 10 nature parks. You can discover the Romantic Road, the Castle Road. You named some of our cities already. And additionally, we have 5 UNESCO World Heritage sites. Moreover, Franconia is not only home of the beer, but it's also known for its excellent white and red wines. So as you can see, the possibilities are as varied as the Franconian beers.
I must admit, I'm always fascinated by the nature parks, of course, and the notion of jubilee in the belly of the earth, which is maybe sort of appearing to my troglodyte nature. It's 100 years ago when it was first opened up with the first cave tourists occurring in late autumn 1922. Presumably, ideally, that's something else that is well worth accessing.
Exactly. In Franconian Switzerland, which is also home of the beer, we have the highest density of breweries worldwide. You can experience the nature, get in contact with the local population and just have a good time there.
That's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today, Jörg. Will you be actually participating or partaking in the beer yourself, or are you a person who actually sort of only drinks tea?
No, for sure. I will be there the weekend.
Excellent. And just a reminder, in case people are actually accessing this particular piece and want to find out further information, is frankentourismus.com the best place to go to?
The best place to go to is, we recommend the Nuremberg Airport for your arrival. There are daily flights offered between London and Nuremberg by Ryanair from London Stansted and British Airways from London Heathrow. And for your onward journey in Franconia, we highly suggest our well-developed network of public transportation. So, for example, it's only a 10-minute ride from the airport to the city center in Nuremberg. And for the next weeks, we still have free capacities. So have a look at the booking platforms and come and explore Franconia.
Ausgezeichnet. And again, a reminder, so the web address for further details, the usual 3ws.frankentourismus.com. For the moment, Jörg Henschel, travel expert, of course, from Franconia. Huge thanks. Viel Glück, viel Spaß, and auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you, Alex.
On Friday, the 13th of December, Bruce and Bongo discovered Germany's most successful word, guile.
The disc jockey's guile. The disc jockey's guile. I said the disc jockey's guile. Guile. Everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. I said everybody's guile. Everybody's guile, guile. Everybody's guile, guile. Everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. Guile. Boris is guile.
Boris. Athens in Guile. Athens in Guile. Athens in Guile. Everybody's guile. I said everybody's guile. Everybody's guile. 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 Everybody's guile, 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 everybody's guile. We're so guile, you're so guile, I'm so guile, guile. We're so guile, you're so guile. I'm a creature of the night. Ha 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 ha.
I think it's been about 7 years since I last played Bruce and Bongo. Might be another 7 years until I play them again. Who knows, maybe they'll be voted in on Wednesday on the Drake Drive. Maybe Robin Pierce might appreciate Guile, Bruce and Bongo.
Oh, we can only hope.
Yes, is it one that's going to make your playlist? I suspect not.
You know, I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah.
As soon as we had, I'm glad we had the conversation about Boris, just to clear things up.
Yeah, it's not Boris, is Guile. Boris Becker is Guile. Yeah. Well, actually, he's not so Guile. He's in jail now. So actually, yeah. Boris Becker, not so Guile because of tax evasion.
Sad.
Both Borises, nicht so Guile.
Not a wunderbar.
Nicht so Guile. Nicht wunderbar, indeed. Never mind. Iona Bain coming up very shortly with some sage financial advice for first-time buyers and ways to actually work your way through the mess of all of the confusion that occurs within that, which is what Iona actually does, because she is the young money blog person who we like to turn to at such matters. And speaking of money...
Give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money. Everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money. Money.
Well, 2,000 homeowners have recently been surveyed, and the majority of those homeowners are baffled by the whole process of buying. Yes, indeed. And many questions actually leave first-time buyers in particular baffled, which is with as many as 6 in every 10 feeling that they are overwhelmed when they talk to the likes of estate agents, solicitors, mortgage advisors, and so on. So maybe to unpick this, we've called on two fabulous individuals. One we already know is a superhero when it comes to money expert keeping and such like. That's the awesome Iona Bain. How are you, Iona?
I'm very well, Alex. You are, as ever, too kind.
Oh, always very true. And we also have the head of mortgage products at Skipton. That's the fabulous Charlotte Harrison. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for the introduction.
Excellent. Iona, were you surprised by the sheer scale of ignorance when it comes to questions that effectively you may well take for granted, many people possibly do take for granted, but actually haven't got a clue when they start talking about things like, what is stamp duty?
Well, Alex, I wasn't surprised that 80% of people are too embarrassed to ask, you know, questions like how much of a deposit will I need? What's conveyancing? Should I offer less than the advertised home price? Because, you know, it's understandable. It's very difficult to admit what you don't know. And buying a home today is very complicated. I'm about to make a shocking admission, Alex, which is that I don't know all the answers to these questions. I had to kind of brush up on all these things when I was buying my flat last year. But I was shocked by the fact that, you know, so many people, according to this research, say they are overwhelmed when they're talking to brokers, estate agents and solicitors, because I think that that's a reflection of the jargon that is introduced into the whole process, in my opinion, unnecessarily, because actually, you know, when it comes to money, often jargon is something that's just there to really confuse and mystify and baffle people, but it's totally unnecessary. And actually, I think that if we stripped all that jargon out and we just answered people's questions in a really straightforward, clear way, then people would feel so much more confident about buying their first home, which is why it's great that Skipton have identified these questions that first-time buyers have, and they've answered those questions in a really helpful, jargon-free way, which, I mean, I wish that this had been around when I bought my first home many years ago, because I found the whole process really confusing and overwhelming too.
I'm tempted to say that if you can't have plain speaking in Yorkshire, of course, home of the Skipton Building Society, where can you have plain speaking? But
well, indeed.
Charlotte, looking at the sort of aspects there, listening obviously to Iona's very appropriate sort of line that actually the jargon that's there often to obfuscate and complicate issues and to almost provide a kind of a mystical act to the whole thing. Was that something you were deliberately attempting to actually break away from and actually get into plain English?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, that's an absolute fair reflection, and probably what we do is that some of that financial service jargon or whatever it might be is there to help the individuals that are processing that element of a case or going through that element step of the process. But you're absolutely right in that that's not helpful for people that don't live and breathe it. And you know what, Iona made a really good point, because we don't buy houses all the time, do we? We're not, you know, it's not something that we do week in, week out. We purchase a property, we purchase our home, and then we live in it for years. And so irrelevant of just first time buyers, but actually, you know, home movers, whether you're not, you're buying for the second time, the third time, the fourth time, you still need some of that help. And so that's why we're trying to really help with creating a jargon buster in plain English. So answering those questions, cutting through all the technical aspects and just understanding what does it actually mean to me.
And Iona, again, we seem to recall a few years ago, we did a little feature which suggested that there was a significant proportion of 20 to 25-year-olds who actually thought stamp duty referred to philately. No, nothing at all to do with that, but, you know, it's understandable. There is that confusion that comes across. So hopefully this provides, again, much more information that people can actually use to make those decisions in terms of whether they should make this very significant commitment in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. And it's funny you should mention that, you know, the question of what stamp duty is something that Skipton has covered in their list of questions, because, you know, it's one of these things that people might, you know, pretend that they know the answer to. Maybe down the pub with their mates, they'll go, oh, yeah, I know what stamp duty is. But actually they go, no, I'm not sure I do. So look, none of this is, you know, something to be ashamed of, actually. It's OK not to know the answers to all these questions. This is very technical, specialised stuff. And there are so many parts of the home buying process here. You've got the legal side, you've got the mortgage side, you've got to deal with an estate agent, and then there's all the issues around conveyancing and surveys on the property. So, I mean, thinking back to when I bought my flat last year, it took several months, and I actually bought during the stamp duty holiday. So there was this added sort of pressure there to get the purchase over the line before that holiday ended. So, yeah, there were a few sleepless nights, lots of back and forth between me, my broker, my estate agent, my mortgage lender, and so on. But once I finally got the keys in my hand, I just felt such relief and joy, because actually, you know, this was a place that I could call my own. And time and again, we see research showing that young people want to get their own place, not just because of the fact that it's usually a wise investment and they usually get an advantage over renting in the long term financially, but also because it's psychologically so important to have that sanctuary and a place you can call your own.
I must admit, you mentioned obviously the questions first time buyers want answered to in a list of 40. What is stamp duty is number 13. My two personal favourites, and I'm not sure, Charlotte, whether you agree with respect to this, but number 31, what do solicitors do all day? Which I thought was a classic. Yeah, you know, I mean, I've often wondered that. Many years of time, actually, what do you do all day? And of course,
no comment.
Actually, I just want to jump to the defence of solicitors here. My solicitor's been an absolute superhero over the past year. He's pulled several late nights, particularly during the stamp duty holiday. So at times like that, they're working all day and sometimes right up into the evening as well.
Yeah, they are.
So I'm sticking up for solicitors.
Okay, well said, Iona. Because the other one, which I must admit, I thought was wonderful, was why do solicitors charge me to print things? Which is
no, well, that is a fair question. I wonder that myself. Yeah, but there we go.
It's a different line. Charlotte, where can people go to find out the key jargon busting answers to the questions and those top 40 questions that first time buyers want answers to?
Yes, so you can visit our website. So we partnered with language app Babbel and created a jargon buster, which is available on our website, along with a whole host of other guides, tips, things around affordability, etc. So that's www.skipton.co.uk. We are also hosting a series of first-time buyer events, which is called Keys to Your First Home. The first of which is due in London on Tuesday the 5th of July, and that is another opportunity for people to come ask all the questions that the list of 40 and I'm sure more with experts all across the home buying process and journey to really help inform and hopefully leave less baffled.
Charlotte Harrison, Head of Mortgage Products at Skipton. Huge thanks, and always money expert and author, Iona Bain. A quick plug for your money blog, of course, Iona, it is.
Yep, Young Money Blog, and also my recent book, Own It.
Exactly, absolutely brilliant. Huge thanks, take care, and keep on keeping on.
Thanks, you too, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What do solicitors do all day? That's one of those unanswered questions.
Siren Radio.
Maybe they just listen to Siren Radio. And why not? What better way to actually sort of enjoy the whole process if you're dealing with a legal case than listening to Siren Radio? You can get all the podcasts as well. Just go to sirenonline.co.uk. Or if you want to have access to Midweek Drives and Midweek Drive Morning Editions over the last 12 or 14 years, you can go to southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com and have all heaps of other goodies from that point of view. Still to come, Lee Purves, the PRCA chairman for the North of England, at least. That's Public Relations and Communications Association. So, yeah, I should be very interested in this because it's a PRCA, public relations thing that Lee Purves talks about in her own wonderful way. Plus, we've got Luke Gamble, who's a vet, discussing the challenges of lungworm. Lungworm. I'll say that again. The challenges of lungworm. Meanwhile, back in the Batcave with respect to Catwoman, Scat Catwoman, that darn Catwoman.
That darn Catwoman.
Is Pussycat, or is it Leslie Gore?
Thank you.
Great news as far as the midweek drive is concerned, because we're delighted to actually be able to welcome one of the leading lights behind public relations in the world today, and certainly with respect to the PRCA, Lee Fabulous. Lee Purvis to the programme. How are you, Lee?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
It's great to connect with your good self. And let's start off by talking about that wonderful thing that a lot of people spend acres of time talking about, it would seem. What exactly is public relations? How would you define it, Lee?
I would define public relations as simple storytelling, actually. Storytelling, which you can obviously do in various ways. And obviously storytelling affects and impacts every day of our lives. I'm not saying that we all, you know, go to PR every minute of every day, but it, you know, it's storytelling, whether it's, you know, passing back to small children, you know, what you've eaten for breakfast, or whether it's me telling you what I did last night with the PRCA, which we'll come on to, I'm sure. You know, it's all storytelling. And actually, I remember somebody I worked with years ago in a PR agency had a really good explanation, and her grandmother had asked her what she did for a living, and she worked for a PR agency. And she simply explained it by saying it was basically like writing journalism, writing stories, but in an advertising style, which actually I surmise is quite a good explanation.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you actually avoided the classic line that a lot of journalists say, which is, it's the dark side of journalism. That's nonsense. I've been battling against that for years, really. It's a whole new field. Clearly, we live in a world where there are billions of stories that are actually around from that point of view. And there are lots of changes in terms of how PR is adjusted over the years, ever since, of course, Edward Bernays and Ivy Lee started arguably started off what we would refer to as the modern incarnations of PR back in the 20s and before then. So in our current experience, would you say that PR is in a healthy state, or is it a case of, well, for every Allegra Stratton that actually occurs in Downing Street, there are thousands of other PR agencies who are doing some cracking work? I mean, you know, looking ahead next week, for instance, we have the Linkages show, Cartwright Communications, looking after that from the perspective of where they're developing. There are lots of other small agencies that are developing their own particular strategies. Are we in a healthy place, do you think, as far as the industry is concerned?
I think the industry is in a very healthy place. I was actually at an event with many agency leaders last night, and we had a really good, frank and open discussion about the state of the industry at the moment. Lots of business, new business pipelines emerging, you know, healthier economy. Economies. One thing that we did actually carry out recently at the PRCA was a survey regarding PR salaries, just to reflect to you and underpin how healthy the industry is at the moment. And that is that 28% of our members have been paying more, significantly more, to their staff to support during this, you know, crisis we're facing in terms of high rising costs of living. So that just reflects and underpins how healthy the industry is at the moment. And actually, you'll notice more and and more jobs are coming up. Obviously, that's a whole other conversation. But again, recruitment is buoyant. Things are really starting to turn a corner. And yes, of course, you always get the bad stories that you hear, you know, regarding PR. But at the end of the day, where would any of this be without it?
What drew you into the industry, Lee? Just share with us. I mean, we talked about obviously your definitions of PR and so on, but what kind of led you to do this as opposed to any of the other many and varied careers you could have actually headed off to?
Well, it's interesting because I actually started off as a journalist, a trained journalist, working in tabloids many moons ago. And I guess just because you're good at something doesn't necessarily mean you enjoy it. So I actually went into PR thinking, oh, I know this is great. You know, and obviously we all know the hard sides of PR as well. But I can write stories, I can source stories, I can, you know, and to a certain point, sell in stories. And that was a part that I actually, most people don't like that, but I absolutely loved it. And I think it's basically because I love talking to people and I love communicating. So for me, it was a natural. And then I was working in PR for years and years and years, and people get saying, oh, you're really good at it. But actually, I kind of missed a bit of journalism. So I sort of fell back into doing both simultaneously, which you can, of course, do. And actually, the two go hand in hand quite nicely together. So I think for me, PR was all about making things happen. And certainly for many of my clients for years, it was literally about landing them coverage and, you know, giving them the fact that I'd met the KPIs, you know, for a certain client. And actually, there's quite a lot of creativity that can come with working in public relations as well. You know, whether you're thinking of a new campaign for, I don't know, the railways, or, you know, you're thinking of a stunt or an event to capture the nation's media, you know, on a shoestring budget. There is a lot of creativity that you can put into working in PR.
It's worth noting for the benefit of the listener who might be saying, what's that TLA then? Three-letter acronym. KPI is basically Key Performance Indicator. It's something we get to use on a regular basis, and there you are. We even have KPI indicators for Siren Radio, up to a point, and the University of Lincoln, obviously. Lee, we're talking as we speak, as World Clean Air Day is actually being celebrated. Now, we're looking at the programme in terms of the schedule, right from our opening feature with Professor Frank Kelly and Sean Ng, from Dyson, of course. We had a feature of World Clean Air Day. We moved on to talk with the product manager at Audi discussing clean air. That's Johnny Byrne. Jorge Henschel was talking about the reopening of the world's largest beer garden in Nuremberg. And Iona Bain, of course, is providing more sage financial advice. And we follow you with Luke Gamble, who's talking about the challenges of lungworm. Now, the one key factor that every one of those stories and features actually has on the Midweek Drive is clearly the fact that initially, they were raised by public relations agencies, PR agencies who are raising the aspect, contacting us at Siren, working through that process, letting us know about them, etc. And is that one of the key areas and key reasons why, just in terms of variety alone, there's a whole stack of things that certainly public relations and communications actually entails?
Absolutely. And I think I'm a Gemini and I do get bored quite quickly, actually. And I do think that, you know, working on a whole range of clients, which I have done for many, many years, you know, one minute I could be working with one of our leading retailers, you know, on a store situation, a crisis, perhaps in Northern Ireland. And then the next minute I could be dealing with a well-known supermarket, or I could be working closely with a really important charity. It's quite close to my heart on a really serious campaign. You know, and I think that's a really interesting section we could look at in terms of public relations and why working it in the first instance, because it can be so varied, you know. And I used to split hours, certainly when I worked and led a PR agency. So each client would be given certain hours of my time. But actually, the days that I was dedicating a full day to one client wouldn't be my most productive. And what I tended to do was split the day in half. So do 4.5 hours for one client, and I know 4.5 hours for another client, but totally different sorts of clients. You know, one could be B2B, business to business, and one could be consumer. So again, that's just the way I work at my best. And it would obviously depend on how anyone else would work. Some people prefer to just do 4 days on a row for one client, but again, it's variety, isn't it? Not only sort of managing your own workload, but also managing your clients and what they want as well.
Do you feel in terms of the media industries, because obviously there are a wealth of different products out there, you can obviously produce your own material now. A lot of our stories and people that we've worked with end up actually using interviews for their own website, developing their own material and so on. The classic UGC, the three-letter acronym, user-generated content, comes across in terms of how we're seeing things there. Do you feel that helps? Because certainly a lot of the stories that we've covered within that, and it's something we are very keen to develop with our students and indeed general staff at Siren Radio, that variety is really important, and sometimes there's a strength in that variety, which if you just literally went through a one-size-fits-all form of commercial radio where it's, well, we only play this and we don't want any advertorial or infomercials coming in at all, they effectively somehow we lose that. I mean, I'm really asking you, Lee, what do you think about the landscape of media that's actually out there, and is it in a healthy position, or is it a case of, well, you know, we could always do it with a bit more variety?
No, I think it is very much in a healthy position. And I think one of the things that I always talk to clients about, you know, years ago, it used to be a really hard sell to try and convince them that they should be doing a blog. I remember one of my former clients quite a few years ago now was a big chain of dentists across the nation. And they were really opposed to doing their own blog. I was like, well, people want to know, not just about your teeth, but, you know, they want to know what they can be doing to improve their teeth. You know, make yourselves the experts, position yourselves as the experts by writing a blog. And at the time, it was just for their website. And actually, it really took off. However, there is so much out there, isn't there? You know, social media platforms, TikTok, you name it. I was just doing a huge conference about TikTok, actually, and the powers of TikTok. Podcasting, we all know, you know, that's a great business tool. You know, anyone can make a podcast. You don't have to be a presenter or a producer. It's really easy. You know, if you think about the rise in people making podcasts from their homes, certainly during the pandemic, that's had a huge, profound impact, certainly on PR and business to business. So that's something not to rule out. Obviously, digitalized content, videos, the more you can offer, the better. And again, it's variety, isn't it? And it might be the strangest client or that you would never fit with a blog and a podcast, but actually it works really, really well. And some of the best successes my clients have had is from being diverse and offering, you know, a breadth of different media platforms from which to promote their product or brand.
Later on this year, we'll actually be celebrating our 5,000th podcast, which started off back in 2008-2009. So it's interesting, again, how that's developed and continues to grow. Let's talk a little bit, Lee, about the PRCA, the Public Relations and Communications Association, which clearly you're one of the key managers for in terms of Yorkshire. There are other areas that sort of work. I mean, there's the CIPR, the Chartered Institute of Public Relations, the other agencies within that. Do you feel that, I mean, well, first of all, share with us how important the PRCA is in acting as a bridgehead between what we do in universities, for instance, and what we do when we're working with students, and of course, the real world, to use that dreadful line that's often referred to as, well, it's all very good, the ivory towers, but what about the real world?
So the PRCA has been, I mean, I've personally been a member with them for many years before I went to work very part-time for them. And actually, you know, the one thing they have always done and done it very well is bridge that gap. So for example, with our student members, you know, we offer a lot of training, support, networking, activities in terms of, you know, we're happy to advise them about, you know, employment, work placements, getting your foot on the ladder, what to do, what not to do, flagging networking opportunities, and actually also speaking to our more senior experienced members to obviously, you know, encourage their sort of inputs into our students and the future successes of our students. I think it was November, Apprentice Week. You know, we always talk about past former case studies who've been students with us and gone on to do, you know, the exact career that they wanted, land the career job, you know, the job of their dreams. And I think we're really, really encouraging and also very real about the what's out there for students and graduates, and also like to talk about what is actually going on in the industry. Even last night, I mentioned before this a big event, talking to many members of PRCA, you know, recruitment came up again, recruitment. My line is, well, what can you do for our student members? What can you offer them? What support can you offer? You know, how is employability? How is recruitment going? You know, everything that we can pass back to our members, we certainly do.
And as ever, presumably the very existence of an organisation like the PRCA.org.uk adds to the professionalism. It kind of becomes less of a random chance aspect, and it becomes something where there's a genuine professionalism about the craft of the industry, let alone the reliability and ethical standing of the institution.
Absolutely. And the other thing as well about, you know, being accredited by a leading global organisation such as PRCA is it does make employers, potential employers, take you seriously. You know, also we have a code of conduct, which many of our members, you know, everyone adheres to, which again is another form of being taken seriously.
Lee, how do you relax? How do you unwind when you're obviously not coordinating the PRCA work and all the other elements and running your own material? What's the sort of area that you work with to actually sort of just chill out a little?
It's really interesting you should ask that, because I did actually go see a life coach not long ago, and I just couldn't relax. I couldn't relax in the middle because I was so, you know, busy. I just found it really, really difficult to unwind, as you'd probably imagine. However, I said to her at the time, I said, oh, I go to the gym. And she said, that is not relaxation. And I said, no, it is for me. It really helps. And I am a bit of an exercise junkie. And she said, no, that's part of your lifestyle. What do you do to relax? And it's funny you should say that, because this morning I heard on the grapevine, I've missed the latest episodes of Stranger Things. And I suddenly thought, right, that's it tonight. I'm binge watching that. So I try and watch TV or TV that I can just escape in. But more recently, I actually had a holiday for a few days. It was amazing. I read a book, and I'd forgotten how important it is to read a book that's nothing associated with work. Just a bit of escapism, a bit of fantasy. And actually, I'm quite happy to go to bed and just read a book to unwind, just as I did last night after quite a late work event. You know, I came in, made a chamomile tea, and I read a book. Rock and roll.
It's the way forward. PRCA.org.uk is clearly a go-to web address for people who wish to find out further details about the PRCA. I'm intrigued, though, with the Stranger Things connection. Does that mean that you're a fan of Kate Bush and Running Up That Hill?
Oh, yes. Absolutely love Kate Bush. In fact, Kate Bush, I got married about 4 years ago, and Kate Bush, one of her songs was my wedding song. But I've always been a big fan of Kate. I think she's fantastic.
So musically speaking, as we're heading to that choice, would you prefer some Kate Bush, or do you have another left field suggestion in terms of, actually, if you're asking for a favourite particular artist or piece of music, this is what I'd go for?
Oh, no, Kate Bush every time, definitely.
Running Up That Hill?
Cloud busting, if you've got it.
Cloud busting it will be. Lee, we've got two final questions we need to put to you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
It's been lovely, a lovely pace, and always gorgeous talking to you.
Oh, my word. Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again when hopefully we'll have some students as well joining us? And who knows, you might be able to join us in one of our live midweek drive shows as well. Will you return?
I absolutely would love to.
Split.
Lungworm. It's a challenging aspect for canines at the best of times, but over a third of dogs which appear healthy could be silently carrying this potentially fatal parasite and indeed spreading it. And to actually address this, we're delighted today to welcome the awesome TV vet, TV presenter, and indeed charity chief executive officer. That's wonderful, Luke Gamble. How are you, Luke?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, I'm great. Thanks. I'm great. How are you doing?
Well, okay, but obviously a number of our canine friends are not really causing, basically due to this lungworm pest, really. I mean, it's very much a parasite, but just explain what lungworm is and how it can really impact on more than one in three dogs in the UK.
I know. I mean, it is scary, isn't it? I think the relevance is there's loads of parasites out there, but this one is on the increase, you know, and I think the worrying thing about the recent stats is, you know, 42% of dog owners just don't know that it's a real threat and around. I mean, it's carried by slugs and snails, so it's a little parasite. There's lots of different types of lungworm, but this is a specific one called Angiostrongylus fusarium. And basically what it does is it causes a range of symptoms in dogs. So some dogs can be asymptomatic. They might not really show much at all. You know, they just might be a little bit off color, maybe not quite themselves. But then very sadly, there's a proportion of dogs that can get incredibly sick. So what it can do is it can then cause clotting issues, seizures, you know, all that sort of stuff, vomiting. And in some cases, it can cause sudden death. So it's a real worry. And this whole campaign, all about raising awareness about lungworm, be lungworm aware, is basically to tell people, you know, go and chat to your vet, get some monthly preventative treatment that will look after your dog and make sure it's not at risk of this horrible disease. We know it's surging across the UK. We know it's wet and warm. We know there's loads of slugs and snails about, you know, so protect your dog, happy health, happy, healthy pet, happy, healthy home, all that kind of stuff, you know, and make sure everything's protected and good.
I was amazed to find that dogs can also become infected by drinking water from puddles or indeed playing with their toys which have been left in the garden. Just licking the grass can actually facilitate the transmission of this parasite. So it's very much a ubiquitous problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's the thing. It's dogs that go out first thing in the morning. I mean, I've got four dogs. They're absolutely nuts, but they bundle out and they'll grab a stick or a ball or something that's been left out in the garden or a garden toy. And of course, you know, there could easily be a little slug or a snail on that, you know, or they can drink from a puddle when they're out on a walk and ingest one accidentally there. But even more relevant is actually the parasite can be spread in the trail, in the sort of snail trail or the slug trail itself. So even if a slug or a snail has crawled over a stick recently and the dog picks it up, can still get infected with this horrible parasite. And it's also spread by foxes as well. You know, one in five foxes in the UK have been found to sort of be carrying the parasite. So it really is now rife everywhere. And there's a cracking map, actually. If people go to lungworm.co.uk, they can type in their postcode and they can see how many cases of this lungworm have been reported around them. I did it around me. I'm sort of in the remotest part of Cornwall at the moment. And there was 27 cases just sort of on my doorstep. I was really, really surprised by it. So it is worth dog owners going to their vet, having a chat, saying, look, I need something to look out for this and protect my dog, you know, and they'll give you some monthly treatment and job done.
Interesting. Just looking at the cases in Lincolnshire at present, there are apparently 95 cases within a 50-mile radius of the Siren Radio studios. Wow. Just looking at that. I mean, one shouldn't panic about the whole thing, but it is one of those areas which certainly raises that concern. How easily treated is this, Luke?
Well, that's the good thing. I mean, I think prevention is always better than cure. That is the number one message. But if we pick it up, you know, we can treat it. The thing that makes it hard is because the range of clinical signs are so variable, it's actually not as straightforward as it sounds to diagnose. You know, you've got to run that specific test. And if your dog's just a bit off colour or not exercising quite as normally, I mean, there's a huge number of things that can make dogs be like that. Absolutely loads. So it can actually get quite expensive. You take your pet in, you end up doing loads and loads of tests and finally find out it's lungworm. Once you found out it's lungworm, you can sort it. But that is providing your dog hasn't got too sick already. So it really is just one of those ones, you know, treat it like ticks or fleas or anything. Let's just get it sorted, get it covered, and just get the monthly treatment. You can get the monthly treatments that cover loads of stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be specific for one lungworm. It's not like you've got to get an extra one. You just want to get one good one that can cover a range of parasites, and then everything's sorted out.
And is that web address lungwormmap.co.uk the best place to go to find out further details and information about the lungworm challenge?
Yeah, lungwormmap.co.uk or even lungworm.co.uk is a good one because it can give you information about lungworm as well, and you can find all the stuff there. So brilliant.
Luke Gamble, Vets TV presenter and indeed charity CIO, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and keep saving those canines.
Thanks, Alex. Bye.
Not to be confused, of course, with teeth, which are also canines. That could be very dangerous
in
a lot of ways. Dialing back a little bit there, Yaz, you're a public relations graduate, soon to be public relations and communications. Did you have any thoughts about what we heard from Lee Purvis and the PRCA?
Yeah, a lot of great things. Definitely interested. You know, these are some things that jobs have as benefits in their job descriptions that I see as I look for job hunting.
What drew you to do public relations and communications at the University of Lincoln?
To be honest, I wasn't going to do it. I was going to do film and music, but I didn't. And I took a gap year, and then it was just like, oh, what do I do now? Then my teacher was like, you'll be good at PR. And I was like, okay, I'll take your word. And then I put how much? Nine grand on it.
and it's exactly, and it's led you to the Siren Radio Studio.
It has.
Took time, but you got here. It's an important thing. And Kathy, any thoughts from yourself about either Iona Bain's financial advice, Lee Purvis, or Luke Gamble?
Oh, man. I guess I got a lot of comments, but I'm going to keep it short and brief, you know. To go with Iona, I'm really grateful that she didn't tell us to not spend the money on coffee every week. I'm glad that we focused more on financial jargon because I do think that's important, especially a lot of people in my age group who are looking to buy homes and start that process. You end up studying for weeks, and then you still feel ill-prepared when you have to talk to someone official. And then with Lee Purvis, I mean, I am a journalist, so I will never succumb to the evils of PR. I say that, and then I'm sure in 2 years things will change.
Well, you know, Jörg Henschel, of course, all set up for the reopening of the world's largest beer garden. Did that appeal to your good self at all, Kathy?
It was wunderbar. Of course it did. Wunderbar. I would love to have the beer at the beer garden, in the largest beer garden in the world.
Mm. Well, you have to content yourself with the Linkage Show next week.
I mean, I'm going to be happy to. There's plenty of opportunity there.
Lots of things. And the New York Book Festival as well. It's fantastic. Yes, have you enjoyed your latest and first Midweek Drive Morning Edition live?
I sure have.
Will you be back again next week?
Sure.
Excellent. Kathy, what about yourself?
I'm always here. You can't get rid of me
if you
want
to. That's not strictly
true.
You mean you've been
what?
There are moments where you actually haven't been on the train's been delayed, you've fallen asleep, there are all sorts of other areas, but you know, physically, yeah, but you know, spiritually, who knows?
I always have the intention of being here.
And the road to Hades is paved with good intentions. But we will certainly say thanks to Professor Frank Kelly and Sean Ng, NG, in case you're wondering, Sean Ng, from Dyson and World Clean Air Day. Robin Pierce, thank you. Robin, thank you. Sarah Huntley, thank you to Johnny Byrne from Audi. Thank you to Jörg Henschel, Iona Bain, Lee Purvis and Luke Gamble. And of course, Kathy Amanso and Yaz de Graaf in the studio. Thank you, dear listener. Lots of great stuff coming up as ever on Siren Radio. It's Florence and the Machine and My Love, which is going to see us out, followed by, let me see, I think it's a case of the news will be happening after that. So, all great stuff as far as the system is concerned. The system, of course, always wins. We know this. It's a fact. You'll sleep better. Right. The Midweek Drive Morning Edition saying farewell. Can we say farewell?
Goodbye. Farewell.
Farewell.